Welcome back to American Capital, our podcast tracing the development of capitalism in the United States. From the first corporate ships to complex economies defined by trade, factories, and finance, up to the business models that exist today. What is capitalism? Where has it been? Who made it that way? And where are we going? In this episode, we'll be going on a tour of the colonies. As mentioned previously on American Capital, one of the possible answers to the question, when does America become capitalist, is from the beginning, that it's founded in a fit of exploration by these adventurers who were the first kind of venture capitalists. But another way people have answered this question is to say, look at the colonial economies. Some of them look quite capitalist, and they've generally said that about two sets of colonies, which look very different from one another. People have said that the New England merchants and the Puritan societies that founded them were the beginnings of capitalism. On the other hand, they've said that slave economies that were producing vast quantities of tobacco and sugar are the ones that look most like capitalism. In this podcast episode, we'll tour those two kinds of societies and talk about what they looked like, so that we have these two models in mind as we go forward. So, where are we going? Virginia, where we'll talk about tobacco, the West Indies, where we'll talk about sugar, and New England, where we'll talk about trade. The way that people make their money is the most important thing if we're trying to discover the rise of capitalism. Many people believe capitalism is more of a cultural system, more a system of ideas, than a system of property rights and a system of production. Last episode's theme was expansion and encounter. The first question was, who came to the New World? The Portuguese and the Spanish, but eventually the English, who will be our focus for this podcast, as well as a particular business model that developed very early, that of bringing slave labor to land that was either vacant or had been taken from native peoples and growing staple crops. On the Azores, Madeira, and the Canary Islands, these things all come together to produce sugar, which makes huge profits for the Portuguese, and that's the model we're going to see appearing in the British West Indies. The second important thing was that these guys are motivated by mercantilism, also called war capitalism, which is a system with much in common with capitalism, as it comes later. In mercantilism, capital is important, trade is very important, markets are important, but it's also quite different from capitalism. Mercantilism is extremely interventionist. Governments believe that they need to intervene in the economy in order to secure their power. And mercantilism is zero sum. If we have two nations trading with each other, we don't think like we do today, that they both get better off. We think one wins and one loses. This is a pre-modern idea about growth. Here, we shouldn't expect there to be growth. We shouldn't expect the pie to get any bigger. We're fighting over who gets what and how big of a slice, not how to make it all bigger. Secondly, in the last episode, we talked about how these are funded by joint stock companies, which are innovative in many ways. Some of these companies are still around today due to their perpetual nature. The second half of the last podcast was what they found when they got there, native groups. The point we made here, basically, is that these guys don't fit any of your stereotypes. I mean, I'm sure we're all super sophisticated, but we should know that those stories about Indians handing away all of their land for a handful of beads aren't really true. In the sources we touched on, instead we saw that the native people were savvy traders, and the dependence is mutual. The colonists are often as dependent on the native people as the native people are on them. And when we say there's a gift economy, that certainly doesn't mean it's not a sophisticated economy, that the existence of kinds of rituals and gift-giving don't make trades any less cunning. And finally, the fact that we're not trading money, but stuff, also doesn't mean that kind of exchange is primitive. We looked at that great price list in the unit of beaver pelts, where we can see that beaver pelts are working just like money, even though it might not look like a traditional financial exchange. Our closing point last time, which isn't really a substantive point, but just something to keep in mind, is that if we're talking about both of these societies relying on each other, that this dependence lasted for a long time, for decades, and in some cases centuries, and what determined the colonists' victory here is not necessarily guns, not necessarily technology, but to a large extent, it's germs. Germs and disease are the kind of ultimate thing that turns the table in these trading relationships, rather than technology or money or any of the things we traditionally think. Now, back to this episode. Where are we going first? The glamorous and failed Virginia Company. The charter is issued in 1606, and in 1607 you have the founding of the company, or the colony that's led by the company. This is immediately followed by a starving time. They were expecting to grow oranges, they thought they were going to find gold, and all kinds of resources. They even brought with them a jeweler because they believed he would be useful in assessing the output of the colonies. Instead, the Virginia Company colonists find something totally different. It's swampy, it's cold, they can't grow any of the stuff they had expected to be able to grow. And what makes things worse is that these passengers, like the jeweler among them, are not prepared to get to work to help them survive. The captain, John Smith, tries to get the colonists to assist. He tries to get them to grow crops, but they were expecting something a little bit more glamorous, and they're not expecting to do any of that kind of work. As a result, the initial deaths are devastating. Of the initial 104 people who arrive in the colonies, only 38 were alive 9 months later. In December 1609, there were 220 colonists, and after that winter, only 60 remained. In total, by 1622, the Virginia Company had transported 10,000 people, and only 20% of them were still there. Not all of these people had died. Some had left as quickly as they could. But regardless, this is a terrible settlement rate, and it doesn't look like the colony is going to succeed. What saves the colony, of course, is the growth of tobacco. The native tobacco in Virginia ends up being incompatible with the European market. This is a tobacco that grew wild in Virginia, but it was really harsh and it didn't meet the European palate. It wasn't a productive export. But John Roth begins planting seeds from the West Indies, and this is really interesting, because this is still incredibly early, and we're already seeing people experiment with how to grow different crops that are successful in different areas. Roth begins planting seeds from the West Indies, and in 1617, the colony makes their first shipments of tobacco. By the 1620s, they're making profits, and by the mid-1620s, they're exporting a lot, 200,000 pounds. By 1638, 3 million pounds, and this number continues to skyrocket. Unfortunately, by this time it was too late to save the Virginia Company, which had already failed financially, but it was in time to save the colony. As of 1780, around the time of the Revolutionary War, they're exporting 100 million pounds of tobacco. In 1620, when they're making their first kind of sizable exports, they started at a point of only 10,000 pounds. And of course, what happens between these two points in time is that the prices fall dramatically. The prices do eventually stabilize, but you have tobacco going from a very expensive luxury good, which is only consumed by a small number of people in England, to a mass market good consumed all over. What does this price drop mean? It means that many more people are smoking tobacco, but it also means that for the Virginia colonists to make a profit, they have to sell much more. And in order to sell a lot of tobacco, the Virginia colonists needed to bring more labor. They had an abundance of land, and they hadn't yet run into problems with land exhaustion, but they intensively needed labor. As you can imagine, given that starving time period, it was difficult to get people to voluntarily come to the colonies. A quote from George Washington says, "If you can't send money, send tobacco." Tobacco becomes a kind of equivalent currency in the way beaver pelts functioned in earlier colonial history. There was a shortage of currency in the colonies. Here, again, we have a staple crop stepping in to be traded as if it were money itself. But the larger problem that these guys face is attracting enough labor. The first solution to that problem is through indentured servants who dominate the early labor force. At this time period, slaves were too expensive to import, but England had a surplus of laborers. There were a lot of people who didn't have enough work in England. Unfortunately, none of them could pay for their passage to Virginia, and the system of indentures emerges. Someone pays for someone to get to the New World, and in exchange for that payment, they owe them a certain term of service. Take the experience of Richard Lowther. In exchange for being transported to the land of Virginia, he promises 4 years of labor on Edward Hurt's plantation. This is an indenture that was signed with the destination in mind. Lowther knew who he was going to work for when he went to the New World. But people also imported others without a planned destination. They were actually sold on auction blocks. Someone would come and they'd be indentured for 4 years. And in just the same way as slaves were sold on auction blocks, an indentured person would be auctioned off to the highest bidder. The treatment of these indentured laborers was terrible. They were often whipped, they were treated a lot like the slaves were during this period. And to make matters worse, this period of indenture of 4 years meant that the planters had no incentive to keep them healthy in the longer term. It was in the interest of planters to work these indentured servants as hard as they could over their period of time. If they did something that the master didn't like, their terms could also be extended. For example, a woman who gave birth to a child by her own master could be punished herself by 2 years of servitude by the church wardens after the expiration of her terms. And these terms are all against these guys. And in addition, they begin to be a problem for the colony. Many don't survive their indentures, but some of them do. And when they do, they need land and work. This makes them both people with poor prospects and a social problem. We don't want to have this kind of class of landless people who don't have a clear role in our society. A shift occurs around 1700, after almost a century of settlement, towards race-based slavery. And there are a few things that motivate this. First of all, the life expectancy increases. If you're coming to this disease-ridden environment and you only expect the average arrival to live for 6 or 7 years, which was probably about right, then paying someone for 4 years makes a lot more sense than paying for the entire life of someone. In the beginning, it made sense to only pay for 4 years of someone's time rather than paying for the entire slave. But as the life expectancies change, this is no longer the case. Secondly, slavery becomes more race-based. Early in this period, there wasn't a hard and fast line between the white indentured servants and black slaves. As mentioned, these European indentured servants who have been free begin to create a social problem. The interest of the society at large is served by creating a firmer divide along the lines of race. As more and more African slaves are imported, the rhetoric and legal systems start to treat people differently by racial lines instead of just by legal status. Some examples of this include restrictions on freeing slaves. The idea here is that slavery is not just a condition of property, but it's something that's indefinite and it may be inherently connected to your racial identity. There are also fines for interracial marriage, and these illustrate the effort to keep racial identities separate. This had the benefit for the colonies of masking white inequality. Not only are you not bringing in more people, who are all going to want their own land, who are all going to need help, but you're also making these people feel as if there's a different kind of social divide. And they can be made to believe that they're on the better side of all of this, even if they're being treated poorly in reality. Here's an illustrating quote from a Virginian taken from around that period. These two words, Negro and slave, have grown homogenous and convertible. Prior to this period, these were overlapping categories where Black or Black Africans were maybe more likely to be enslaved, but by around 1700, and certainly another decade or two later, these two things become difficult to distinguish in this society. At the same time, wealth is consolidating. In 1700 in Virginia, the richest 5% of families own more than half of the property. Race-based slavery helped to secure continued dominance. It increased the capital requirements for planting, which made it harder for small planters to get into the game, and it also encouraged those people that were there to move south and west, to move away in search of better opportunities. And it also diminished the incentive to continue importing indentured servants. Race-based slavery begins to solidify alongside the staple crop model, but it does take a century to get there. This is a story where the staple crop of tobacco emerges by 1620, but the race-based system of labor that's going to support it doesn't consolidate until 1700. By the time of the first U.S. Census in 1790, Virginia is about 40% Black and about 40% slave. There are a handful of free Blacks, some of whom own slaves themselves, but basically these two quantities are the same. It's also the case that 40% is a huge fraction of society, but this is nowhere near the proportion of enslaved that we're going to see in the next region, the West Indies, where, as we'll see, the proportion of enslaved is much higher. So now, we cruise down to the West Indies. We'll actually talk very narrowly about the two most important British settlements, those in Barbados and in Jamaica. These are two very different islands. Barbados is small and it's well adapted to sugar production. Basically, the entire island can be developed. Jamaica, by contrast, is much larger, but it's also a much larger challenge for governance. Not all of Jamaica is adapted to sugar. There are areas with mountains where you have maroon communities of escaped slaves. There are also areas that are owned and developed by the white planter class. Our discussion applies especially to Barbados, because Barbados is the first large British producer. The planters' control over the island of Barbados is much greater than it ever is in Jamaica. In addition to these two islands, the British do have smaller holdings, but these places look relatively the same, they're just on a smaller scale. The first thing to notice is that the shift to slavery occurs faster and earlier in Barbados and Jamaica. By 1660, the majority of people on Barbados are enslaved Africans. This never happens in Virginia, which by 1780 gets to be about 40% enslaved. In Barbados, the population of slaves is about 82,000, or about 85% of the total population. Slave code began to solidify the alignment of race and slave status, and also began to create other limitations on things like intermarriage that could threaten this situation. But again, if we were to zoom back in, even this kind of consolidation of race and slavery isn't totally predetermined. The first slave rebellion in Barbados is in 1649. It's a collaborative rebellion between white indentured servants and black slaves. It's not successful. It's almost immediately put down. But these two groups unite, basically on the grounds that they're not getting enough to eat. The other thing to notice here is that the British West Indies are a very different society in terms of social control. Having 80 to 85% of the population be enslaved requires much more hierarchy and a stricter set of provisions to keep the society going. In some ways, it's amazing that anyone ever managed to rebel as a slave, but it's also amazing that the planter class managed to maintain power with this much of the population enslaved. That's a theme that we'll talk about more later on, but it's worth pointing out. The reason that people talk about this as an origin story or an origin setting for capitalism is because of the nature of sugar production. Sugar production is typically called the system of factories in the fields, because it's an industrial system of production. Sugarcane is not near the sugar that we consume, and sugarcane spoils quickly. It has to be processed quickly, and because of that, you need a field setup where you're growing the cane, and either really near to it or literally on the same plantation, you need a sugar mill to grind the cane. After you've ground the cane, its juice perishes very quickly. You also need to process that juice right on site. So you basically need a factory co-located in an agricultural setting. Let's go through the process that transforms sugarcane into sugar. These agricultural processes themselves are very complex. Planting was overseen by gangs of slaves who were managed by drivers, bookkeepers, overseers, and agents. There's a hierarchical organizational model embedded into these processes to keep them running. A chart from the late 18th century shows how the slaves are divided up in one particular day. In this example, there are three gangs. The top gang, for example, has 60 slaves divided up between a whole bunch of different activities. Each of these three gangs would be supervised by a driver. The driver was sometimes enslaved as well, and above him the bookkeepers would be recording all of this activity and managing it. An overseer would be in charge of a whole plantation, and then above the overseer, you would have a manager or an agent who would likely oversee multiple different plantations. This is quite complex, even if we just talk about what's happening in the fields. But after the cane is grown and harvested, it begins processing into the final product. First, it's pressed in the mill. These early and relatively primitive mills were run by animal power, but eventually they begin to use steam power and water power when it becomes available. After the cane is ground into a juice, the juice is boiled into molasses. Technical drawings from the period show the system for doing this. Imagine a series of huge metal pans. The initially thin, clear juices from the sugarcane begin in one pan, and they're slowly boiled down progressively to refine the sugar content. A quote from a source describes how it happened. The juice is conveyed in pipes from the mill to the boiling house. Here it is converted through a succession of coppers. At each, a slave is placed to take the scum as it rises, and when the temperature of that vessel has had its full effect, to remove it with the ladle into the next. An overseer, or manager, is often included in these technical illustrations of the process. This is extremely difficult and dangerous work, and we can't capture it all from a picture. Some of the images from this period appear to be airy and pleasant, but these are steaming kettles of scalding molasses, right? This is an extremely unhealthy environment, and it's also the place where the most skilled, most valuable slaves worked, but it was also very detrimental to their health, and it contributed to the high mortality rates in the Caribbean. Eventually, the sugar is boiled down. Once it gets to its thickest state, you arrive at a byproduct, which is the kind of molasses they are going to keep. And then you have the muscovado sugar. This is a thick, hard, brown sugar, and it looks somewhat similar to the kind of sugar that we have today. This sugar was formed into sugar molds, which were finally shipped across the Atlantic. As we mentioned, the disease environment in the British West Indies is extremely problematic. After that early starving period in Virginia, the slaves there began to reproduce. Slaves never end up reproducing in the setting of the Indies. Here, the system essentially ate laborers. There are a few instances where slaves survived and lived a long life, but those are the exception. The life expectancy was usually around 40 years or below. One document collected as a plantation account from Jamaica in 1767 shows a balance sheet of enslaved laborers. It's essentially a balance sheet of lives. Rather than dollars, the unit here is humans. At the beginning of the year, an inventory was taken. You have the births, which are a very small list, and on the right-hand side of the document, all of the various causes of death on the plantation. It illustrates a typical scenario, where the planter is just losing many more slaves per year over time. This had a couple of effects. It encouraged absentee management. It encouraged people to go back to England, which meant that much of this reporting had to happen on paper. People had to write a lot of this stuff down, and they had to figure out ways to do business from a distance. And the nature of this system also required continuous imports of new slaves. One other point on this balance sheet. There are a whole bunch of different columns listing all the professions on the plantation, all the different things that the slaves did. There are also a couple of columns for children. So this was an extremely complex market, where you needed a lot of skilled laborers to do all of these various different activities. And all of these dynamics put together meant that, at least on the ground, people are afraid of rebellion. Here's a quote from a Jamaican planter, who's a resident in Jamaica in 1776. He writes, "The men of this island pay ample contribution in order that it be protected, not so much from the French or Spaniards, as against the machinations of the many thousand slaves, which in proportion in settlements advanced further into the heart of the country, grow the more formidable from their multitude." This is a setting where the interests of those in the islands are starting to divert from the interests of people back in England, where they're mostly concerned with imperial competition, with the French and the Spanish. On the ground in Jamaica and in Barbados, maintaining control is more important. You might believe that the forces would tip back in the other direction, but what's happening is that producing sugar is exceptionally profitable. And even as people are getting more afraid, the prices of slaves continue to go higher. Planters continue to be willing to pay those higher prices, and people continue trying to import them. The prices of sugar and the prices of slaves roughly move together over time. Even as people are more and more afraid of rebellion, even as you have kind of a social tinderbox on the island, people are making huge profits, and the price of slaves continues to go up. A quick side note is that many restrictions evolve over time here. The slave trade itself is also abolished in 1806, which we'll talk about later on, but ending the slave trade meant that your property was less movable. For example, if you're buying a slave in Jamaica, you could sell it within Jamaica, but you couldn't sell it to another island. On the other hand, the sources for people to get slaves begin to dwindle. Instead of having one kind of a central market, smaller, separate markets emerge. Alright, now we're heading back up to snowy New England. And despite all the snow, it's actually true that, you know, while you wouldn't want to be the investor for someone's journey to New England, if someone was to choose where they could go, at this point they might begin to prefer New England to the other colonial options. In 1620, the Pilgrims land in Plymouth, and they benefit from an epidemic that had recently decimated the coastal Indians. They actually occupy an abandoned village when they got there, which already had cleared fields. Things are starting off badly for the native peoples, but really well for this group of pilgrims. And because New England was colder, it also had a better disease environment. You know, on the one hand, cold is a big problem, but on the other, it meant that they weren't, like, sitting in the middle of a swamp full of germs, the way that people in Virginia were. Unlike the earlier Virginia colony, the governors of the Massachusetts Bay Colony actually relocate to Massachusetts as well. They have more flexibility and authority to make changes in the way that they're doing things on the ground. And by contrast to that starving time, and to the kind of demographic disaster that happens in Virginia, this is a grand success story. Not only do people live, but between 1630 and 1640, there's a great migration. 14,000 English Puritans come to the New World, and they make offshoot Puritan colonies spanning out across New England. Not only do lots of people come and lots of people survive, but they also reproduce. A demographic shift is happening in New England. By 1700, there are 91,000 people there, and in the Chesapeake, there's a migration of 120,000. By contrast, in the West Indies, 190,000 are incoming, but there are only 33,000 in 1700. Part of this is that not all of these people are dying. Some may have never intended to stay in the West Indies, but in New England, they stay. And this population growth resulted from three core factors. The first is that they survive. It's a healthier population on arrival. These guys aren't indentured servants who can't pay their own way. They get there and they're healthier, and their life expectancy ends up being about 70 years. That is, if you make it out of childhood, then you could expect to live to be 70 years. Not that far off from life expectancies today, although the childhood mortality rate was still really high. But regardless, this life expectancy contrasts to the less than 45 years elsewhere. The New England colonies reproduce. They come in families. There were way more women in New England. I mean, there were still more men, but way more women than elsewhere. And then finally, these colonists are arriving because they're looking for religious freedom in addition to economic opportunity. So they're way more likely to stay. They also bring a lot of skills with them. There are skilled craftsmen who come. But what do these colonists produce? If we look at the economy of colonial New England from a distance, there's a total lack of a major staple export. And this is largely because they aren't going to be able to grow any of the crops that Europe wants. They do export some fish and furs as well as some wood, for example, like the tall trees are in demand for ship masts, and most of those have been cut down in England. But they don't have a major staple export. This is a big problem for them, because they want to import manufactured goods. And if they don't have anything that the English want, it's going to be hard to get those goods. They're able to do their own subsistence production, but there's a lot of stuff that they can't make. And there are two solutions to this problem. One is that they need to do more manufacturing, and indeed they found the first manufacturing enterprises in North America. They begin to establish printmaking facilities. And this is the type of production that's showing up in New England, but not in Jamaica. You know, there's a little bit of printing in Jamaica, but it's not nearly on the same level. And their other strategy is to become middlemen, or carriers in trade. It turns out that nobody in England wants the stuff that they're growing, but people in other parts of the New World do. The New England colonists may not be able to grow the really great grain that's grown in the Chesapeake, which is in demand in Europe, but they can grow certain products. They also do some processing of other things, those that are in demand in the West Indies. They begin taking their goods to all over the New World, and in the process they become shipmasters and the middlemen in the trade. If you were to ask yourself, who are the important people in this society? In Virginia and the West Indies, the important people were planters. Here, in New England, the most important kind of person is a general merchant. What is a general merchant? This is the kind of a person who is at the center of this web of exchange. Take Thomas Hancock, for example, who is a kind of typical merchant. He's the son of a bookseller, and he apprentices for 7 years to become a bookseller in Boston. When he was 21, he opened a bookshop for himself called The Bible and Three Crowns, which was in the North End. The conditions of trade at the time were such, there was a lack of currency, and you had to resort to barter. And this requirement to resort to barter compelled him into more varied business activities over time. If you wanted cash for your books, you weren't going to sell any books. You had to be willing to take whatever people were willing to pay. Over time, Hancock becomes a partner in a paper mill. He starts to export codfish, whale oil, logwood, and potash. He supplies rum and provisions to Newfoundland, and he owns shares in freighting vessels. And as he begins a greater and greater variety of goods into his store, the store becomes not a bookstore, but a general store. He becomes a wholesaler and a retailer for goods all over New England, someone whose specialty is not really in books, but in making financial exchanges. And in this process of becoming the middleman, he becomes not just a general merchant, but also a banker, someone who's issuing credit to lots of different individuals that they can pay over a longer period of time. The merchant becomes the banker, and a growing finance and shipping center of the economy emerges. The next thing I want to share with you is a source from Thomas Hancock, and this is amazing. Imagine that you had this as your first work opportunity. This is a letter from Thomas Hancock to Captain Simon Gross, who's working for him and is going to run one of his ships. The letter is dated December 20th, 1743. Hancock writes to Gross, "You have command of the charming Lydia Brigantine in all respects, fit for the sea. Take the first wind and weather for sailing and proceed to the West Indies. You have liberty to go to any of the English islands, and, if you think it safe, to any of the French islands. And after delivering your cargo, pick up a load of molasses, shipping any excess on the best terms you can get, or bring it in indigo. Your share will be 1/8 of the cargo loaded aboard, and 1/8 of the proceeds from the sale of the cargo you obtain. And then it gets really fun. Hancock writes, "If you can get good freight for Holland or England, you may take it. Or, if you have the opportunity to sell the ship and its cargo, you have my consent. You have the freedom in every respect to act as you think best for my interests. But if you plan to return here, a load of molasses would be the best thing to bring. In every opportunity, I wish you a good voyage." This isn't a clear business model. This is someone who's basically taking advantage of whatever kind of arbitrage opportunities present themselves. Whatever is priced low that he can sell high in one location to get to another. Hancock even told him that he can sell the ship. And nobody, I mean, I don't know, maybe some, if you develop an app, you're allowed to sell the app. But you're certainly never allowed to sell your ship today. It really shows that not only is Hancock becoming a middleman and has to have a trusted person who he can send out there, but it also shows that he's starting to come into conflict with what would have been the British interests here in the New World. Earlier in American Capital, we talked about mercantilism, and I'm going to return to it in a second. But notice here that Hancock has just told him, look, go ahead and go to those French islands as well. Just do whatever you can to earn the most profits. And before we get to that, just in summary, the New English become the middlemen of the web of Atlantic commerce here. And in some ways, this is a kinder, gentler origin story for a capitalist society in the New World. These guys are merchants, they're innovative, they're learned. Who becomes a powerful person here? The bookseller. Isn't that like a rosy picture? But of course, they're not only carrying fish, furs, and whale oil. They're also carrying grain, tobacco, and sugar, which are all grown by slaves. And, of course, they're carrying the slaves themselves. They're very intertwined into those other regional economies. One of the big questions for the American Capital podcast, which we'll return to over and over again, is who ends up being responsible? If we're going to say that the shipment of 12 million slaves across the Atlantic in horrible conditions to do unremunerated labor is one of the great tragedies of the modern world, which of course it is, then who's responsible for that story? And what does that have to do with capitalism? Obviously, those guys in the Caribbean who are running plantations are in some way responsible, but to what extent are these middlemen responsible? And as we get to the next episode, forget about the people who are literally carrying the slaves as commodities. What about the people who are just in it from the finance side, who are only providing the insurance or something like that? These questions illustrate a theme that we'll return to over and over again in this series. Before we leave New England, I also want to make a further comment about New England versus the West Indies and versus Virginia. Those in Virginia are making staple products with a demand back in Europe. This is also true for Jamaica. They're growing stuff that people want. It fits neatly within a philosophy of mercantilism, where trade is going to make the economy stronger. And this is not true in New England. Not only are the New English willing to go to different ports when they're not supposed to, but they're also taking some of the profits of that trade that people believe should be going back to Europe for themselves. And in response, by the mid-1600s, the English begin attempting legislation to reassert control over colonial trade. And these have effects on all of the colonies, but they're most sharply felt in New England. They help pass what we call the Navigation Acts, which are actually a long series of different measures, and these begin in 1651, but they get progressively harsher over the long period leading up to the American Revolutionary War. There are three specific impacts of the Navigation Acts for our podcast today. The first is that they say only English ships could trade with English colonies. This restricts where people are supposed to go, and who's supposed to go where. Second, they say that there are certain colonial commodities, like tobacco and sugar, that have to go to New England. The English recognize that those guys in Massachusetts are making some stuff that nobody in England wants. They're fine with that going to other places, but certain products have to go back to England. And finally, they levy taxes to reap the benefits from all of that exchange. The New Englanders are usually considered English ships, but not always. And as the Navigation Acts go on, there's more distinction made between the colonists and the proper English. But also, this suggests that, say, French ships couldn't go to trade in English ports. A lot of the merchants in the colonies want to trade with others, with different nationalities. There are certain ways that this could potentially benefit them, right? The New Englanders could benefit because to some extent they are also English ships, but it creates a lot of restrictions on them as well. If you just want to be that middleman, like Captain Gross, who's been sent off to do whatever profitable trade he can find, this is going to create a lot of restrictions. Mostly, they're talking about things made in England, but they could be things coming through England that are shipped to the colonies. They have to pay taxes on those. Say you want to buy Finnish cloth, then the colonies had to pay high taxes. Alright. As we mentioned before, this is all kind of a simple story about crops. What you grow determines what kind of labor you need, and what kind of labor you need determines what kind of society you have. Virginian tobacco requires slave labor, not in the same proportion as sugar, but you end up with a pretty unequal society, with a lot of race-based slavery. In the West Indies, you need even more labor to grow sugar. It's an even more dangerous process, even less pleasant, and you end up with a highly, highly unequal society, where race-based slavery is dominant, with between 80 to 90% of the total population being enslaved. And then there's New England, where you have a system in which no staple crops could be grown. Surely, if they could have grown sugar, they would have, but they can't grow any staple crops. People leave them alone as a result of this. Because they don't need a lot more labor, the society that develops there is relatively egalitarian. Additionally, the business that the New English are involved in is one that requires a pretty high level of education. You get high levels of literacy. You could see how you could take these crops or business lines and construct a whole theory of how these societies develop. New England begins relatively poor, and as a result, people leave them alone. They have trade, they develop literacy, they become this egalitarian and productive society. By contrast, in the West Indies, sugar makes the people rich. It also makes them unequal. And today, the West Indies can be seen as kind of a huge mess. Alright. So that's one way you could explain the whole world by skipping the intervening decades. I mean, we're oversimplifying, right? Which we always are, every time we try to explain anything. But an alternative way that people have talked about capitalism is to say, the stuff isn't important, it's really all about ideas. It's all about the assumptions that people bring, it's all about the existence of particular types of entrepreneurs and certain types of outlook. This is a question I want you to ask yourself as we look at the two primary sources for this podcast. The first one is John Cotton's On the Just Price. But it's not actually by John Cotton. What is it, actually? It's secondhand. Cotton was a Puritan minister. He gave his sermons, and John Winthrop kept a diary of what he said in his sermons. So this is like Cotton's sermon as recorded by John Winthrop. On the Just Price is all about a merchant, Robert Keane. So this isn't a published source. It's coming from a diary of what Winthrop heard sitting in on John Cotton's Sunday sermon. The other source we'll discuss, Benjamin Franklin's Advice to Tradesmen, is a published source. This is a polished kind of piece of writing, and these two sources are totally different. Franklin's work is meant to be disseminated. It's for young tradesmen to read in order to learn how to be successful in trade. What happens to Robert Keane? Basically, John Cotton says that Keane has charged too much. I think he's selling nails. And Cotton says, he took above 6 pence and a shilling of profit, in some cases above 8 pence, and then some small things above 2 for 1. This is Keane's crime. He charges these unjust prices in the sale of nails. What was wrong with making up the price? Keane is charging amounts that people are willing to pay, but the church involved says that there's a religious reason not to do this. People claim that it's immoral. And there's also a kind of traditional price. What Keane charges is out of line with this traditional price. So is there a law against what he's doing? No. It's definitely not illegal. And it sounds like Cotton and his parishioners believe that other merchants may be doing this as well. So it's a bit of a bummer for Keane, right? If you were one of these colonial magistrates deciding what was going to happen to him, you'd probably be like, those people didn't have to buy the goods. It's too bad for them. You might not advise people to make the same decision, but you're certainly not going to judge him for it. It's not explicitly against the law. But Keane has been warned by the church officials, and his friends have warned him that he shouldn't be charging these prices. Cotton also states that if, for example, a merchant's ship sinks and the merchant needs to charge more, then even if people are willing to pay your price, you shouldn't do this. And why is that? According to the source, whose fault is it that the ship sunk? Cotton says that if you failed, or if you've lost your ship, God wanted you to lose your ship, and you should suffer that loss. You trying to avoid risk, or to mitigate risk, is actually going against your religious beliefs. This is an alignment of moral situations with this practice of setting prices. Perhaps this is a society in transition. We have, on one hand, Keane, who has all of these incentives that are coming from this world of Atlantic trade, But they're conflicting here with a society that had an established set of moral rules about what was reasonable. And do we still have a concept of just price? There's something here about necessity, right? Keane is in trouble for earning 8 shillings profit, or for selling at most 2 for 1, and this is like the ratio that they're willing to tolerate. There's something about selling for what you said you'd sell it for, and there's something about crazy outlandish prices. Cotton's sermon isn't clearly about one particular sale. It's more that the community had become slowly frustrated over time with what they regard to be a constellation of bad business practices. And further, that Keane has apologized for similar actions in the past, yet he's continued doing it. Here, we're touching on something about monopolies, where we want them to not be able to earn because they have disproportionate power. We don't want them to exploit their position. You also have situations where there's not only one producer. To an extent, because our laws are written in a particular way, we may believe that any price that's legal to charge is an okay price. However, we make similar considerations to John Cotton today if we just shift our framework out of the language of justice and into the language of monopoly or antitrust. Pushing us forward to our next source, the Benjamin Franklin piece. Does this contain the same ideas as the Cotton piece, or had a large shift occurred between when Cotton is writing and when Franklin is writing? These two texts sound pretty different. Franklin writes, "Remember, money is of a prolific generating nature. Money can beget money, and its offspring can beget more." And on, 5 shillings turn to 6. He's like, profits, profits, profits. It all sounds really Wall Street. And is this all of a sudden more modern? Or is it still similar to John Cotton? The relationships Franklin writes about are mostly between him and his customers or creditors or someone he's directly doing business with. He writes that you have to be industrious, you have to be frugal. And Franklin also writes about your creditor hearing you hammering early in the morning, which is like a one-way relationship with the creditor. But in another way, this could be taken to be about your whole social being in your society. By Franklin, work efficiently and you're going to be better off, and you're going to do well. It's aphoristic writing, and he's very quotable, extremely quotable. Almost as if you think, and I'm sure he did, that he's actually going to make money by writing this. For another pivot, is there any religion in the Benjamin Franklin piece? He writes at the end, "If that being who governs the world to whom all should look for a blessing on their honest endeavors does not, in his wise providence, otherwise determine." What does this mean? Setting aside Franklin's complex theology, what is he saying there at the very end? Who is really responsible for your success or failure in the end, according to Franklin? God. Franklin states at the end, he's saying who's responsible. Oh, it's God. But it doesn't seem like he really means it. He seems like he's saying it with somebody watching, in the same way that they were watching Robert Keane. Somebody is watching Benjamin Franklin too, and you have to make sure that you say the right things, but it doesn't sound like he totally means it. The Puritan work ethic is this. It's the manifestation of work hard, be industrious, and do it for religious reasons. Max Weber, a writer working in the 20th century, believes this to be the origin of modern capitalism. This idea that you need to be industrious and frugal, and not only that, but by being industrious and frugal, one can determine what God has in store for them. If we had asked about the underlying similarities between these two documents, Franklin may sound more contemporary, but both he and Cotton blend a kind of moral language with market-based language. The other thing that they both have in common, and in Franklin it's just a footnote, is the sense that if you failed, if you lost your ship at sea, it was because God wanted you to lose your ship at sea. Like, this is providence, and this went with the Calvinistic, Puritanistic beliefs about predetermination. You could work really hard, but ultimately, who was responsible at the end of the day was God. The same thing is true for Franklin, but here it's basically a footnote. You will do well, you will become rich, just follow my advice. As long as God believes, it'll be okay. This is the argument that Max Weber makes for culture being at the center of the emergence of capitalism. His argument is basically religion, and it's a really smart argument. Here's its architecture. Weber says that religion is often associated with a rejection of worldly goods, and this has a unique manifestation in the Puritan setting. Here, theology dictated that if you labored diligently, you could determine whether you were saved. You weren't supposed to do labor because you wanted to get the goods. You were supposed to labor hard because if you were successful, then you would be able to tell that you were saved. Or if the ocean or nature sunk your ship, then that was a pretty bad sign that things weren't going to work out for you. But even if the ocean swallowed up your ship, you should keep working, because maybe you're eventually going to be able to be successful. And it's not only through your own hard work, but if you see that you've been successful, then you'll know that there's a chance that you've been saved. So this is a combination of work hard and be master of your own fate, with you're only discovering evidence of what was meant for you by a higher power. And both of these have a powerful message of predetermination. Weber says that the Puritans worked hard because they're trying to figure out if God meant for them to be saved or damned. They work really hard. They become industrious and they become frugal. They become these very profitable merchants. But he writes that eventually the religion falls away. Religion was not necessary for the persistence of the Protestant ethic. And by Benjamin Franklin's time, the religious structure had already started to fall away. Franklin includes it as a commentary at the end of his article, but it's clearly not, you know, compared to the Cotton Sermon, all about religion and all about society. It's disappeared. Weber writes that by this time, religion had disappeared, and people are striving systematically for profits for their own sake. Again, just earlier, this could be interpreted as a kinder origin story for capitalism. It comes about because people work hard and they're frugal and they try to protect their credit. But Weber gives a warning. This is a different kind of warning than one you'd give for a capitalist society that has slaves. It's a totally different type of warning. But here's his warning. He says, "The care for external goods should only lie on the shoulders of the saint." And here, the saint he's referring to is the saved Puritan. Weber continues, "Like a light cloak, which can be thrown aside at any moment, but fate decreed that the cloak should become an iron cage." Weber is saying we're working for earthly goods, and originally the Puritans weren't working for the sake of those goods, but we've become part of this world of goods, where the goods themselves are what motivate us and also entrap us. It ends up being a dark story, but it's a story about cultural ideas, and this one particular idea that if you work hard, you'll be able to determine if you're saved and if you're going to heaven. This is the key to the ongoing production of the system of capitalism.